This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The UN Children's Fund warns tens of thousands of malnourished children are likely to die as cholera and acute watery diarrhea continue to spread in Yemen and three countries in Africa.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up also. Government as well as opposition forces in South Sudan are accused of committing war crimes. And the head of the African Union says he is deeply frustrated by the silence and lack of action by African leaders in the face of famine. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the rights group Amnesty International says both government and opposition forces in South Sudan Equatoria region have committed war crimes. Its new report says there have been serious human rights abuses against civilians, including women and children, being shocked or hacked to death with machetes and burned alive in their homes. It says women and girls have been gang-raped while homes, schools, NGO facilities and compounds have been looted, vandalized and burned down. Amnesty says hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. It accuses government and opposition forces of using food as a weapon of war, creating shortages in an area that was once the breadbasket of South Sudan. The government has reacted to the report. A spokesperson for President Salva Kiir denies that security forces have killed civilians in violation of international law. He says while it is true that a single soldier may occasionally harm civilians, overall, the South Sudanese army is there to protect the people. The UN Children's Fund warns tens of thousands of malnourished children are likely to die as cholera and acute watery diarrhea continue to spread in Yemen and three countries in Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund warns children are at great risk in Yemen, Somalia, and South Sudan, which are on the brink of famine. The number of malnourished and severely acutely malnourished children in those countries is staggering. UNICEF reports an estimated 4.7 million children in the cholera-stricken countries are malnourished. Of these, UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillerac tells VOA more than 1 million are suffering from severe acute malnutrition.
Let me remind you that a child who is suffering from severe acute malnutrition are nine times more likely to die of disease than a well-nourished child. So having cholera and diarrhea in countries where so many children are so fragile because of malnutrition, among other things, because of such a bad access to safe water is extremely worrying.
UNICEF says it also is extremely worried about an outbreak of acute watery diarrhea in Sudan, where the Federal Ministry of Health reports more than 20,000 cases of the disease, including over 400 deaths. Bouillerac says the disease has spread to 14 of 18 states, and children account for more than 20% of the affected population.
The situation in White Nile State, which is in central Sudan, is deeply worrying since it is the most affected with 7,200 reported cases and since it has almost 100,000 refugees living in camps.
UNICEF says it needs access, security, and more money to contain cholera and acute watery diarrhea in all four countries. It says aid operations must be scaled up. Malnourished children must receive special life-saving medication, therapeutic feeding, and have access to safe drinking water. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The head of the African Union says he is deeply frustrated by the silence and lack of action in the face of the terrible tragedy of famine. Moussa Faki Mahamat expressed his concerns at yesterday's opening of the AU summit in Addis Ababa. He asked heads of state what happened to African values of solidarity and fraternity, what happened to Africa's civil society. The UN recently reported that famine had eased in parts of South Sudan, but that 6 million people still need emergency help. The risk of famine looms in parts of Somalia, northern Nigeria, and Yemen. The UN says some 20 million people in those four countries face severe malnutrition. The Food and Agriculture Organization Conference continues in Rome, as about 1,000 delegates meet on ending global hunger by the year 2030. Michael Clark is the FAO's Senior Coordinator for Governance and Policy Support. From Rome, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the meaning of the term.
It means many things compressed into a single concept. It means hunger, but hunger is one and maybe the most visible and tragic dimension of malnutrition, which includes micronutrient deficiencies, which have terrible medical consequences. And they affect about 2 billion people. Hunger affects about 800 million people in the world today. And overweight and obesity, we've got almost, again, 2 billion people suffer from overweight and 500 million people who are obese. But that is the problem that's growing the fastest today. So all these aspects are part of Zero Hunger, and then Zero Hunger is a strategy that has emerged in the SDGs, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. It really focuses on the crucial role that small producers, family farmers, about 500 million across the globe, play in transforming the world. Not only do they produce about 70% of the world's consumed food, but they are also decisive for many other things, like eradicating poverty, extreme poverty, or ending conflicts. Most of the conflicts in the world today are in rural areas. They're being driven by climate change. And other problems like promoting industrialization in Africa. That doesn't happen unless agriculture changes.
It seems like an awful lot. Is 2030 too ambitious a goal to solve all these problems?
Well, I don't think anyone thinks all the problems of the world are going to be solved by 2030. But I think the big difference was, well, the two parts. One was we'd been focusing on reducing, and at some point said, you know, our goal really has to be zero. And whether it can be achieved by 2030, we don't know. But the concept of leaving no one behind says your ultimate goal has to be zero. The other piece is that we recognize that development really brings a lot of things together. Focus on a problem like rural poverty and hunger, and then see the connections to many other problems, and see how if we tackle this, steal the march on a number of these other issues. So it's not unrealistic, but it is ambitious, and the call is for transformational change. Let's see what we can do.
What do you look for in the outcome of the FAO conference?
Well, I think there was generally a concern that we may be slipping a bit on our work to address hunger and the problems that I mentioned. We see the global economy slowing. We see commitment to international support slowing. We see the effects of climate. If you look at where climate has changed the most in the subtropics and you add to that the number of conflicts that are taking place, you see it's really a belt that goes from Brazil all the way to Indonesia, right through the middle of the world, and this is growing. So all these things are working to sort of push us backwards. We're hoping from the conference is really to get our core constituency to recognize that business as usual isn't going to make it. We need to deepen our efforts, and we need to be fairly strong advocates for what's at stake.
Do you think too much is being expected from the humanitarian agencies to solve some of these problems?
We frankly have a view on taking a humanitarian approach. Of course, when you see people in crisis, when lives are at stake, it's necessary to undertake heroic measures. And much of the work being done by our colleagues in the humanitarian area is heroic today. But the problem is that doesn't really usually change the underlying conditions. And what we've been saying is we need to take a more developmental approach. We need to address the underlying challenges. If climate change is happening, we've got to find ways to make food and agriculture, livestock, natural resources more resilient, change the practices, look at what's causing the waste, look at how you secure tenure under different circumstances. So we are saying that a humanitarian approach doesn't really address the underlying challenges, and we need to go deeper.
Are you positive, even when you look at the current world conditions at this time, that progress can be made?
100% positive. It's tough. It's challenging. We need focus. We need to do more with less. All of that's true. But we've seen evidence that these problems are soluble.
Would the world be much different if all these people simply went to bed with a full stomach?
To go to bed with a full stomach requires a lot of changes, including that people have livelihoods. If we get the conditions that allow that to happen, the world will be dramatically changed.
Michael Clark is Senior Coordinator for Governance and Policy Support at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. From Rome, he spoke to VOH's Jody Capua. More than 100,000 migrants have now crossed the Mediterranean Sea to Europe so far this year. About 85,000 of them have gone to Italy, around 9,300 to Greece, 6,500 to Spain, and nearly 300 to Cyprus. While the figures are high, they're actually much lower than last year, when nearly 232,000 had made the crossing by this time. However, that was before the European Union reached a deal with Turkey to stem the flow of mostly Syrian migrants to Greece. Nearly 2,250 migrants have died making the sea journey this year. AFP reports that on Thursday, European and African foreign ministers, as well as UN officials, will meet in Rome to discuss the migrant crisis. Italy is demanding other EU nations take in more migrants, saying it could close its ports to new arrivals. After being elected earlier this year, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus today became the new Director General of the World Health Organization. In a statement, he said, "The moral center of the WHO's work is about serving people, about serving humanity." He said, "It's about serving people regardless of where they live or who they are." Dr. Tedros added that health is a basic human right, adding, "Without health, people have nothing. Without health, we have nothing as humanity." Dr. Tedros will lead the WHO's delegation to the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, on July 7th and 8th. You were listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies: 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Eighteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Government and opposition forces in South Sudan are accused of committing war crimes. Cholera and acute watery diarrhea continue to spread in Yemen and three countries in Africa. And the head of the African Union says he is deeply frustrated by the lack of action by African leaders in the face of famine. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. An undercover investigation has found much of Africa's illegal ivory trade passes through a little-known town in southern China. The operation was conducted by the watchdog group, the Environmental Investigation Agency. It found the town near Hong Kong is the major hub for ivory coming out of East Africa. Julian Newman is the group's campaign manager from London. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the investigation.
Well, yeah, he's been investigating the ivory trade for a long time now, and particularly that coming out of East Africa. And in 2014, we were doing a field visit to Tanzania And the main reason for looking at Tanzania was the sort of catastrophic loss of its elephant population, which had crashed by 60% in 5 years due to poaching. And through the course of that work, we went to Zanzibar, which has been a major gateway for exports of ivory. And we engaged with some of the local Chinese community, and it turned out they all came from this single town in China called Shuidong. And they were there principally doing marine products business, sea cucumbers particularly, which is their specialty. But over the course of many conversations with some of those individuals, it transpired that members of that community were very active in also trafficking ivory. So fast forward to April 2016, and we were looking at the impacts of improved enforcement in Tanzania. We were starting to hear reports that some of the poaching and trafficking had sort of moved south across the border into northern Mozambique. And while we were engaged in that endeavor, we came across, by chance, three individuals who had the same accent, which showed they came from Shuidong. And over the course of many meetings with these individuals who thought we were investors in ivory, it transpired that they were also involved in the ivory business. And this sort of work culminated in October 2016 when we were able to win their confidence to a degree where we actually got to view a shipment of ivory which had left northern Mozambique in April 2016.
So did you actually go to this town?
Not me personally. Members of my team did. You know, it took a lot of engagement over the course of several meetings to try and win the confidence of this group because they're very suspicious of outsiders. That's one reason why they've never been subject to any enforcement in Shuidong. So it took a while to win their confidence. And finally, we were able to get access to that shipment in October 2016, which sort of proved what they've been telling us about their ability to do this smuggling.
They claim that about 80% of all poached ivory smuggled from Africa to China passes through this one town. Is that correct?
That was their claim, and obviously it's difficult to verify exactly, but it did tally with the sort of previous research we'd done about their presence in Zanzibar, for example. At that time, Tanzania was the main country which was losing elephants through ivory poaching. It also tallied with further conversations we had with them where they were also active in Uganda, in Kenya, and also in West Africa, in Nigeria. So this sort of story made sense that this one group was really at the center of this trade because obviously most elephant ivory shipments go undetected.
Are you able to put a monetary figure on this operation?
It's always quite tricky because prices are shifting and changing all the time, but our impression is that they sort of double their money, more or less. When they get into China, they double their money. That's probably the most lucrative part of the trafficking chain is that step when it enters China. Obviously, they pay local people a fee in Mozambique or Tanzania to collect the ivory. There are payments made for bribing customs and shipping agencies to get it out. There are also payments made along the chain. But the biggest single jump in price is when it enters the territory of China. And we believe that, based on conversations with these individuals, that they expect to sort of double the money they're paid in Africa once it enters China, at least.
Now that this is known, what can be done?
We hope that enforcement agencies around the world really can help to disrupt this group's activities. They've been active for a decade now. At least one of them has had a couple of his shipments seized. But that really is just from a business expense because there's no proper sort of follow-up by enforcement. We hope that our report will show to the enforcement community, customs agents in China and Africa, how these groups operate and the tricks they use to evade detection and so help intercept their next shipments.
That's Julian Newman of the watchdog group, the Environmental Investigation Agency from London. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. In related news, the Chinese government announced last December that it would shut down the country's illegal ivory trade by the end of this year. In the Gambia, a national think tank has been launched by the government of President Adama Barrow. It will focus on a wide range of issues aimed at reviving the political system and the economy, including good governance, reconciliation, and the empowerment of young people and women. Reporter Panderi Mbai has more on the story.
National think tank is the first ever for the Gambia and is part of a national blueprint for reviving the country. President Adama Barrow came to power last December. He defeated former dictator Yahya Jammeh in a highly contested elections, which were marred by a month-long political impasse. Mr. Jammeh later relinquished power and resettled in Equatorial Guinea. The research institution mainly consists of professionals from various sectors of the economy. Ms. Fatoumata Tambajen Jallow is Gambia's Women's Affairs Minister and the overseer of the Office of Vice President. She recently deputized President Barrow at the launching of the national think tank.
This move represents my personal commitment to bring governance and development to all Gambians in the bid for us to build together a new Gambia. This move is also in recognition of all Gambians and our partners in realizing that decision for change.
Ms. Tambajang Jallo says the Gambia has over the years experienced an unprecedented brain drain. She blames the problem on former dictator Yahya Jammeh, who forced many skilled professionals to leave the country. But she says the new institute should help ensure that Gambia's developmental needs will be adequately catered for.
I am proud to say that the National Think Tank Initiative is the first of its kind in the Gambia, and it represents my political vision and commitment of my coalition 2016 government to harness and maximize the integration of an invaluable ingredient in our new Gambian for sustained development.
Ms. Tambajang Jallo says the research institute is part of the new administration's promise to rebuild the country.
My commitment is aimed at fulfilling my campaign promises to Gambians, which is to bring all Gambians on board and provide them with equal opportunities in rebuilding a new Gambia through a new development paradigm, a process in which most Gambians were deprived from participating meaningfully over the past 22 years of the APRC repressive rule.
In recent comments, Ms. Tambajang Jallo also talked about the effects of Jammeh's dictatorship on the nation's youth. She says many have died trying to reach Europe by traveling through the Sahara Desert and the risky sea waters of the Mediterranean. The national think tank will help address the problem by providing better ways of educating and employing youth and women. Political observers say the establishment of the institute is just one small part of a long process needed for the Barrow administration to fulfill political and economic reforms. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Pandey Rimbai in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workiger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we will examine the contributions politicians of African descent are making and changing toward the political realities in the United States. We'll also discuss the new faces arriving on the political landscape on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.